Start from where we were left off yesterday. So we arrived at the so-called frame formulation of gravity. Okay, so as I recalled yesterday, for gravity, we can, instead of describe it in terms of a metric, we can instead describe it in terms of Wilbein and the spin connection, where the Wilbein can be thought as a gauge field associated to translation generators, and the spin connection is the gauge field associated to Lorentz transformation, local Lorentz transformations. And so this PA, MAB, they generate the ADS algebra when lambda is non-zero, when there is a negative cosmological constant. And so this algebra is just a familiar one. And the translations okay, the signs are not important. Basically, when there is a non-zero cosmological constant, they commute into the Lorentz transformations, and so we have SO3,2 in the flat space limit, then this just reduces to the Poincaré algebra in which you have Lorentz and the translations. Okay, from now on I will always stay in the case in which lambda is negative and non-zero, and I will not keep factors of the radius of ADS. No, this is just going to be one. Okay. So then, as I was saying yesterday, it's very natural to combine this Wilbein and spin connection into a single SO3,2 gauge field. Yes. Yes, but when, so in Poincaré this is zero. The translation commute.
Yeah. So when you have coma.
Sorry?
This is not included in conformal. Oh, okay. No.
Okay. I mean, it's conformal group from the point of view of one lower dimension. But this is the ADS algebra. Right? Okay, so we can combine the Wilbein and spin connection into a single SO3,2 gauge field. So these are the generators of SO3,2. The other question? Okay. And so the gauge transformations of this gauge field are now the standard one that you would write in a Young-Mills theory. So if you define a gauge parameter and this W just transforms in the standard way. This is just a compact way to rewrite the gauge symmetry that you have in the Wilbein and spin connection formulation. So they include the diffeomorphisms and the local Lorentz transformations. Okay. Where is the eraser? All right. Okay, so as usual, in Young-Mills theories, from this gauge field, we can construct a curvature. The curvature just transforms in the adjoint under the stage transformations. Okay, and this can be expanded into the generators PA and MAD as I was showing yesterday, explicitly. Okay, so this term here is what is called usually the torsion, and this one is some generalized curvature. So this would be the standard Riemann curvature, and then here there is an extra piece due to the cosmological constant. Okay, and so the torsion usually is, is set to zero as a constraint. It follows from the variation of the spin connection in the Einstein action, and by solving this constraint, one gets omega in terms of the Wilbein, usually. So this solving this constraint expresses the spin connection in terms of Wilbein, and the curvature in general is determined by your Einstein equations. But so one thing that we can see is that there is a special solution of Einstein equations, which is just RAB equal to zero. And this is nothing but the ADS background. So that this is a solution, the easiest way to see it is probably from the McDowell-Mansour form of the action, which I wrote yesterday, which is quadratic in the curvatures. Since that action is quadratic, it's immediate that r equal to zero solves the equations of motion. Okay, but you can see, looking at the form of this curvature, you can recognize that this is just the ADS background. So putting these two conditions together, yeah.
Is ADS the only solution of that? RAB
equals zero. Yes, RAB equal to zero is ADS. Yes, it implies that the curvature is just proportional to the product of matter.
You have to assume that it's non-degenerate.
Yes, that follows.
I said that because I don't think in the McDowell-Mansour form the constraint is explicitly stated. Like, we don't necessarily assume that he is non-degenerate.
Okay, yes, I will always assume that he is known. Okay, so we can see that these two equations in terms of the W can be just stated as the, let me call the ADS solution a solution with some built by E naught and omega naught, which can be combined in gauge field W naught, which is the sum of the two. I'm omitting the generators now. So this condition basically translates in the fact that this SO3, 2 gauge field is just a, it's just a flat connection. So in this language, ADS just becomes a flat connection. It just solves the equation similar to equations that you get from a general science. Okay. Any question? Okay. Now, the reason why I went through this is that Basilev proposes that this formulation is the one which you can most easily generalize to the higher spin case, as I will now show. But before doing that, let me introduce something which is going to be extremely useful in four dimension, which is the two-component spin notation. Okay, so we know, as we are very familiar with, in four dimensions, we can always convert a vector index into a bispinor index by using the sigma matrix. Where alpha and alpha dot goes from 1 to 2. And okay, so if you have you can have undotted and dotted spinors, and there is a SL2 invariant contraction of the spinor indices, which is taken with the epsilon tensor. So and so on. I think we are all very familiar with this. And, okay, so this is how a vector is going to look like in a two-component spinor notation. More generally, if we have instead a symmetric tensor, which is traceless, this translates into a into a multi-spinor like this, where the dotted and undotted entities are completely symmetrized. You can convince yourself that this has the same number of components if you count the components here. And on the other hand, if you have an anti-symmetric tensor like a field strength in Maxwell theory, this in the two-component spinor notation gives two totally symmetric undotted tensor and totally symmetric dotted tensor, which are the self-dual and anti-self-dual part of the YAMMILS, well, Maxwell field strength. More generally, so going up in the spin, if you have
anti-symmetrization.
Yes, thanks. Yes, and these are symmetrized. The Weyl tensor in gravity, which is, so it has the same symmetry as the Riemann tensor minus all traces. This translates into a two, again, and generalizing what spin one does here, this gives a sum of self-dual and anti-self-dual part, and we have a four-component totally symmetric spin. So these are the self-dual and anti-self-dual part of the Weyl tensor. And, okay. So in particular, those Dilbein and spin connections that I wrote before, this symmetries of this? Yeah, the symmetries are the same as Riemann, but you subtract all the faces. So and the spin connection, which is anti-symmetric in A and B, analogously to this, splits into two objects, totally symmetric in alpha beta and alpha dot beta dot. Okay. And, okay, analogously for the generators, right? The corresponding generators, PA and MAB, become P alpha alpha dot and M alpha beta M alpha dot beta dot, which generate two independent SL2 algebras.
You're first contracting all the space-time indices on F and C, for example, with Dilbein before.
Sorry, say again.
On the one hand, on the Dilbein and spin connections, you've translated tangent space into sequence, spin indices.
Yes, yeah. I'm omitting this is always a one form.
Right.
So here I'm just transforming the flat index of the beamline into two components.
Right. I think that's what you always do. So I think actually on the left-hand side of the board as well, you've actually contracted in some... I mean, in flat space, of course, it's fine, but I think in curved space...
Here you are. Yes, yes. I should say that. These are always intended to be flat indices. So you need to transform the curved index into flat. Yes.
It looks like we're going to establish a formalism that's well-rooted in D equals 4, but earlier you said all of this somehow extends to arbitrary.
Yes, the formalism is a bit more clumsy, more complicated, but there is an extension. But in 4 dimension, it's really much easier. Okay. You can do the same thing in higher dimension, but you need to put extra constraints on the fields. Okay. Yes, but this is what makes 4 dimensions very special. Okay, now...
The answer to the question of who did it in higher dimensions is also obvious, right?
Yes. Well, together with collaborators, but... yes. Okay. So now let me now introduce the next ingredient needed in these constructions, which are Vasiliev's twister variables. Okay. So what Vasiliev does is introduces a set of auxiliary variables, which are, let me call it y alpha and y bar alpha dot. Alpha goes from 1 to 2, alpha dot from 1 to 2. These are some auxiliary twister variables, so they are commuting, they are bosonic spinners. They commute, which means in particular that y alpha, y beta, epsilon alpha beta is equal to 0, and so on. So these are twisters. And on this auxiliary space, Vasiliev proposed to define a star product acting on these y's. This star product is defined to act as follows. So and the star contraction of dotted and undotted indices is just the same as ordinary product. Okay, so he introduces this and postulates this star product. Now it will be clear in a second, maybe why. Okay, so in particular, this means that under a star anti-commutator, which just means y alpha star y beta minus y beta star y alpha, this is equal to 2 epsilon alpha beta, and the same for the barred variables, and the barred and the unbarred commute, star anti or star commute. Okay, so this is how the star product acts on the monomials of these variables. In general, you can define its action on arbitrary functions of y and y bar. So one representation is the following in terms of derivatives. Okay, so you can see by expanding this exponential that the step product of two arbitrary functions includes an infinite power of derivatives acting on those functions. So it's, as familiar with step products, is some kind of non-local operation in this auxiliary space. And okay, there is also another representation which is more convenient for calculations, usually, which is an integral representation, which is equivalent to that. You can check that this is equivalent, and in particular for monomials, they just give these rules down here. And here, this integral is written in somewhat formal way. It's always understood that there is a choice of contour here to make this integral convergent. For example, we really assume that an integral like this is a delta function. So strictly speaking, it means that you are integrating over imaginary u's here. This is just a formal expression. You can define the same thing with explicit i's there if you want. It doesn't really matter for the purpose of what I'm going to say. This is the expression that we used. It's just avoids to putting i's, and it's always understood that the integral is supposed to be interpreted in a convergent way. Yeah?
My name's Lucas.
About what the step product?
Just going back to the twist of directions.
Yeah.
Have you fixed some normalization?
Of this integral?
No, your variables, your coordinates. What's the important thing? Sorry, what's the thing? Because I normally think of twisted variables as being tied up to some sort of scalar relation. And it may well be that.
Okay, here by twisters, I really mean just a pair of commuting spins. That's what I mean by twisters. That's.
What's the relation to anything else?
At this point, it's just some set of auxiliary variables. Okay? And that's what it is. They are defined to be two pairs of variables with spinor index.
Yes.
They commute.
Yes.
But you define a step product on this space. You define some operation in this space, which
yes.
is this. And, yes, you can check that this star product, by the way, it's associative with good ones, and so on. Okay, so why we are introducing these variables? So one reason is that now one can use this representation to generate the, well, to realize the generators of SO3.2, where the Lie algebra is replaced with this star, with the star anti-commutators. So basically, the generators now can be represented in the form in the following way. So P alpha alpha dot is y alpha y bar alpha dot, and m alpha beta is this, and m alpha dot beta dot this, and it's it's not difficult to check that now with these definitions and under the star and the commutator, these guys generate the same algebra of SO3,2. I need to put some eyes somewhere. I may not be too careful about that. So this, you have a star commutator of YY with YY. Using that contraction rule, you see that after you take the commutator, the only terms that survive are those in which you contract two of the Ys and leave the other two not contracted. So you get an epsilon alpha beta times a generic. Right. So without the commutator, you would have y alpha, y beta, y gamma, y delta, plus a term in which you contract two of them with a star, and another one in which you contract all of them with a star. The term in which you don't contract anything and the term in which you contract everything cancel out with the commutator. And the left one is this one. And the same for p alpha, alpha dot. Which, sorry?
P squared probably isn't Casimir of this algebra, is that right?
I suppose so. I mean, it's isomorphic to the algebra I wrote in the beginning using the standard brackets. So by P square you mean P star P in this case.
Yeah, I guess it's because of P star.
Yes. I suppose.
Wouldn't the Casimir be some combination of the M squared and P squared?
I'm just
because of the cosmological
concept. If we were talking about the red screen.
Oh, yeah.
If we were, then A, B squared is a Casimir, and B, that form of E, B squared is zero.
Okay.
But we're not talking about the red screen, so I'm trying to work out exactly where that was not implying that there was an instance on chess.
Okay.
Well, that's just the B squared. Well, the B squared is the instance.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, but whatever you know about the Lie algebra of SO3,2, you can translate here in terms of star commutators, just isomorphic. Okay, so now that we have this explicit realization in terms of these auxiliary variables, it basically means that we can rewrite this gravitational, well, this spin two gauge field as a bilinear in this y and y bar. Let me write it in this way. And now the curvature of this gauge field has to be defined in terms of the star product of this. So the curvature now is dw plus w wedge star w. Right? So this is just a rewriting of all these relations in terms of these auxiliary variables and the star product. So you have a decomposition in generators of SO3,2, which now are represented as bilinears in these twister variables. Okay. And so the ADS background, it's the one which satisfies this, as I wrote before. And, all right. Just if you want to know what's the explicit form of this W naught in these variables, so E naught okay, and you can check using the properties of that star product that this solves this flatness condition, and you can recognize that this is the Wilbein of ADS 4 in Poincaré coordinate, and this is its spin connections. So here I'm thinking the metric in the Poincaré form. So the spin connection and the Wilbein of that metric are encoded in this object.
For IZ. Yes, this is the product of sigma I and T. So we've seen that the spin two gravitational fields can be written in this language as bilinears of these auxiliary twister variables. So now Basilev's observation is that to include the higher spin, one simply consider a more general gauge field, which is some arbitrary function of y and y bar, containing all powers of y and y bar. Yes. It's basically just for one. So sigma mu is there is a bar, which means that sigma bar is 1 minus sigma.
Sigma z is 1.
It's, yes, it depends how you contract those indices, it's either 1 or epsilon.
Epsilon is epsilon 2. 1 of them is 1. How do you get non-zero commutator? Is it anti-commutator or not?
First, the Z is on the So you got 2 minus 9. But, well, that could be finished.
Yeah, because of that sign. Okay. Okay, so now Vasilev says,
so the spin two parts are bilinear in wires, so now we take higher spins. Take arbitrary functions of y and y bar, which have you can expand them similar to a superfield formulation, but the difference is that now you have all, these are bosonic variables, you have all powers. So this will contain for this component n, and to denote the corresponding powers of y and y bar. This and then goes from 0 to infinity. And in the bosonic theory, so we define this to be the most general expansion in terms of y and y bar with the restriction that it's an even function of y and y bar. And this is because, so the spin of each of these components here, it's, so the spin of this Wn, n, it's 2s minus 1 is equal to n plus m. So for bilinears, when you have the sum of y and y bars is 2, this is spin 2. Let me give some examples. So another way to rewrite this
related to being even. Why is it related to being even? Why do you have the component that it must be an even function? Oh, because the spin is n plus m over 2 plus 1. And you see that if you want integer spins, n plus m need to be even. So you can relax this constraint if you want to describe also fermionic higher spins. But then actually, that's not the whole story. You also need to include even more extra auxiliary variables in that case for consistency. I'm not going to discuss that case. So, okay. Another way to write this is that the spin has degrees of freedom are contained in the component which has s minus 1 plus n powers of y and s minus 1 minus n powers of y bar, with n going from minus s minus 1 up to s minus 1. It's just an equivalent way to write that thing. So for example, for spin 1, then all we have is just something which is independent of y and y bar. And remember that these are always one forms in space-time. I'm always omitting here the space-time. These are supposed to be one forms. There is always a mu there hidden. And so this guy is nothing but the gauge field, spin one gauge field. For spin two, we already saw it before. Let's see it again how it's recovered in this notation. So we have, for spin two, we have W1, 1, W2, 0, and W0, 2. And these are nothing but the Willebine with one y alpha and y bar alpha dot, the self-dual part of the spin connection and the anti-self-dual part of the spin connection. Okay. For more generally, for higher spins, for example, spin 3, we have W2,2, which is an analog of the Wilbein. So in this case, it's a generalized Wilbein which has two undotted and two dotted spinners. And then there is a more stuff. And these are generalizations of the spin connection in the spin 2 case. So there is always one component, which is the one with equal number of y and y bars, which is equivalent of a Wilbein. And then there are spin connections, which by the equations of motions that we will see later, they can be expressed in terms of the Wilbein, as happens in the spin 2 case. So in the end, you can write the equations of motion for the physical propagating degrees of freedom in terms of these guys, the Wilbeins. So more generally, for arbitrary spin S, as I just said, there is a component which is S minus 1, S minus 1, which is a generalized Wilbein. Going back to the four component notation, this is a so it's a generalization of the standard Wilbein, which has one space-time index, because it's a one form, and has S indices here, which are symmetric traceless. And the relation to the Fronsdahl field is, so after using these symmetries under the generalization of local Lorentz transformation in this case, which are related to these spin connections, you can gauge away the anti-symmetric part of this object and left with its symmetric part, which is then basically identified with the Fronsdahl field with the same indices. Symmetric, these are symmetric traceless,
yeah.
But so it's not symmetric in all indices that this makes sense. But you can gauge away the anti-symmetric part. And then this symmetric part is identified with the Fronsdahl field. And remember that the Fronsdahl field was constrained to be double traceless. And this is automatic here because this is traceless in these S indices, so if you take two traces, this is going to vanish. Because so you could take you can take one trace and you could trace these indices and this does not vanish. But if you take two traces, it must vanish. So this object is double traceless and identifies with that. So with the Fronsdahl formulation.
The mu and A are not exactly on the conical footing, right?
Yeah. Again, you can translate those to flat indices using a background Wilbein. Here, these are really supposed to represent the physical fluctuations around some background. So these are the spinners fields moving in a background. You can use your background metric to convert curved indices into flat indices. Okay. So we've seen before that in the spin two sectors, the motivation was to write down this one form as a gauge field of SO3,2, where the bilinears were generators of SO3,2. So now here we have analogous interpretations. So we want to view this as a gauge field. And now what are the generators? The generators are just arbitrary polynomials in y and y bar. So this, in this language, is basically the definition of what a higher spin algebra is. It's just the algebra generated by star commutators of arbitrary polynomials. Of y and y bar. So this generalizes the case, the spin two case, in which you only have bilinears and give you SO3,2 algebra. Here you have an algebra made of, which is constructed by taking star commutator of arbitrary polynomials.
I don't know, interesting subalgebra other than whatever it was, SO3,2, whatever.
Yes, so SO3,2 is the only finite subalgebra of this. So I will comment in a few minutes. Okay, so those are the generators, then. So you want to view this as a gauge field for this algebra, which means that you can postulate that this gauge field as a gauge transformation, which is just the epsilon. Where epsilon, again, is an arbitrary function of one bar which contains all powers. If you restrict to the bilinear sector, these are just the gauge transformation of the spin two part. And this is what generalizes those transformations to all spins. And so one can see that, for example, at the linearizing level, expanding around the ADS background, then linearized level, you have this is essentially a covariant derivative of the parameter epsilon, and if you expand this epsilon into its components, you can recognize that, after a little bit of work, you can see that this is equivalent to the transformation on the Fronsdal gauge field. But now the proposal of Vasiliev is that this is the correct definition to interacting level, not just a linearized level. So here you can have also the fluctuation fields themselves appearing. So this is the appropriate, according to Vasiliev, generalization of what the Fronsdal, free Fronsdal gauge symmetry is to the interacting level. Okay.
That you did in the upper right corner. Were you already using this gauge symmetry that you are now presenting?
To do this?
Yes. To do the last step. You were already using this gauge symmetry, right?
I'm already, well, yes. This, yes. I already believed everything here.
Yes, I was already anticipating in my mind that you can write down such a gauge symmetry, and the components which are associated to those analog of the spin connections are those which allow you to gauge away the anti-symmetry. So in the spin S sector, this parameter epsilon will have a component with S-1 indices, which is the one which basically corresponds to the just a diffeomorphism transformation of the Biedmann. And then there are all other components which are associated to those spin connections and are analog of local Lorentz. These are the ones which allow you to gauge away the anti-symmetric part. Okay, so as was already observed a minute ago, we have seen that if we take bilinears instead of arbitrary polynomial, then this star commutator just produces bilinears, which means that the algebra restricted to bilinears is a subalgebra of this higher spin algebra, which is SO3.2. And in fact, this is the maximal possible finite subalgebra. One can see that if you have a polynomial L, a PL with degree L, total degree L in Y and Y bar, so the sum of Y and Y bar is L, and so L1, and you take the star anti-commutator, commutator. This, in general, by doing those contraction with star products, include several possible polynomials whose degree range is. So you see that if you have a bilinears here, L1, L2 equal to 2, then on the right-hand side, you only have bilinears. But once you start including components which correspond to higher spins, then this is no longer true. For example, if you consider polynomials which are fourth order, which corresponds to having spin 3 by this relation. So something which is of order n plus n in the y and y bars as spin given by this relation. So spin 3 corresponds to a quartic polynomial in the piece. You take this star anti-commutator, you find that this produces a term which is bilinear in the y, plus another term which has 6 powers of y's. So these in total have 8 powers, total powers you can contract. And these are the only powers surviving after you take the commutator. So this is spin 2. But this is now spin 4. So you see that if you include spin 3 in the game, you will immediately generate spin 4 by the star commutator. And this goes on. Once you have spin 4 can appear in commutators, and then you will have spin 5, and so on. So this shows that, in general, if you want to add even one higher spin higher than 2, then you have to include all of them. So this algebra, these theories require infinite power of spins. There is a possible consistent truncation of such an algebra in which you only select even spins, and that only produces even spins. You can check it by this star contraction rules. So there is actually a minimal AHS, higher spin algebra, which only has even spins. But you still need an infinite power of them.
Any questions? Okay, so now we are slowly moving to writing down what are the equations of motion for this sphere. But we, so the ingredients that we have introduced so far are not enough yet. When you think you already have a lot of formalism, Vasiliev tells you that you need more. And he proposes that the most convenient way to write down these equations is to enlarge this twister space even more. So from this y alpha, y bar, alpha dot, Vasiliev proposes to double the dimension of this space and introduce two more twister variables, which we call zeta and zeta bar.
Okay. That's a new question.
The one
that
W.
Yeah.
Not quite. They look like flatness once you introduce these extra variables, but that's the trick. Once you go down to physical components, they are not just flatness. Otherwise, there will be nothing propagating. Okay. So we introduce these new twister variables, and these twister variables, they have non-trivial contractions from the star products among themselves and with the y's. So together with the rules for y's, we, in addition, have rules of contractions of the z's, which is the same as the y's with a different sign. And there is a rule for contracting z alpha and y's. Let me write it this way. Okay. If you think this is strange and you don't know where it's coming from, I would agree with you. And so just bear with me and let's try to see where this is leading us. Okay. No, sorry. Okay, so more general, you can generalize that star product formula that I had before. Why I never find it great.
So where is it?
It was there, in Abra red project. I can still see it.
No, I was looking for the eraser.
Ah!
Oh!
Let's see.
Must have dropped it somewhere.
Yes.
Ah, okay, thanks.
You don't want to like one.
Yeah, which one I should use now? It's...
Who can bring it?
Oh, which one?
I'm still confused.
Is that on that one there?
This one?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Okay, so you can define the star product of arbitrary functions of y. Let me make notations a little shorter. Let me collectively denote as a big y and y bar, and as a big z and z bar. Okay. So the star product is a rewriting, slight modification of what I had before. Okay, so it's almost the same as what I had before. The difference is that now you include dependence on Z, and it's defined in such a way that there is this minus sign difference, which basically generates a difference in sign here. And you can see that there is also a non-trivial star contraction between Y and Z, which turns out to be important for writing down the equations. Okay, and so one property of this star product is that it admits some special object which Vasilev calls the Kleinian, which is this exponential. And this guy, you can check using this definition of star product that it has the property that k star k is 1, and the same for k bar star k bar, and it also acts, if you take k star arbitrary function of y and z star k, what this does is flipping the sign of y and z. Okay, again, so for now this doesn't really mean much, right? Let's try to go on. So the space in which the equations will be defined is space-time plus the y's plus the z's. And now we need to write down what are the fields in terms of which we want to write the equations. So the fields, we have this w that I've been discussing before, but now it's a function of also of the z's. This is a one form in space-time. Then we have an extra field, which Vasilev usually calls S. Which is a one form in the auxiliary Z space. Right. And then we need a one more field, which is a scalar master field. Okay, this is a scalar. And in the bosonic theory, these functions are constrained to be even functions of the y and z. For example, w. The same for B, and actually S is an odd function. S alpha and S alpha dot are odd functions. The same for alpha dot. These are just some constraint which in the end tells you that the physical degrees of freedom are just bosonic. And actually the physical degrees of freedom in the end, after we have introduced all this extra Z stuff, physical degrees of freedom. Are contained in this master field projected down to the ZZ bar equal to zero component. So the physical degrees of freedom are.
Yes.
So this is at Z equal to Z bar equal to zero is the field which I was discussing before, which contains generalized Wildbahn and generalized field spin connections. This extra Z and Z bar is just a convenient way to encode some extra auxiliary fields that are needed in the construction. And the physical components are at the Z equal to Z bar equal to zero. And S is purely auxiliary object. Which can be chosen to be just a zero in the Z equal to Z bar equal to zero restriction. So this is purely auxiliary. And B, again, so B is now in the physical part of this big master field. This is some new function of Y and Y bar, which I didn't discuss before. This, if you expand it, again, it will have all powers on Y and Y bars. And in particular, so this is, I said, is a scalar. The scalar doesn't have any, it's not like W, which is a one form. So in particular, in the components which don't have any powers of Y and Y bars, B00, this is a scalar field. So in this theory, besides spin 1, 2, up to infinity, there is a scalar field. And it sits inside this extra master form B. And then no, because they have spinor indices.
Also physical?
Yes, I'm going to write it down now. So the other fields are related to the higher spin fields in the following way. So the component with 2s y's and the component with 2s y bars. So these are B alpha 1, alpha 2s, and B bar, well, minus alpha 1 dot, alpha dot 2s. This will have an interpretation which, well, you have to look at the equations of motion to see it. But in the end, on shell, this will be interpreted as some generalized Weyl curvature. So they are expressed on shell as derivatives of the gauge fields, of the higher spin gauge fields. So for example, for spin 1, this is nothing but F alpha beta and F alpha dot beta dot. For spin 2, these are the standard Weyl and in general, these are some generalization of the Weyl curvature for spin 2. So it's some object built out of S derivatives of the higher spin gauge fields. Okay? And so these are the S, 0 to S components. More generally, all the higher components which have more powers of Y and Y bars. These guys are related, are auxiliary objects and are related on shell to these guys. No, I mean plus. So n goes from 0 to infinity. It's an infinite tower of auxiliary fields, which have arbitrary high number of y's and y bars, with the difference being 2s. Those are related to those guys. I said these are, so they are auxiliary. On shell, they are related to derivatives of the Weyl curvatures. Yes, and so yes, those D2S, 0, 0, 2S also contains physical degrees of freedom, but they are curvatures for the gauge field.
They are
not the auxiliary, but they are written in terms of the gauge field. They are curvatures. Okay, so once we have introduced this z and z bar coordinates, we have an even larger gauge symmetry group compared to what I wrote before. And this gauge symmetry group now, so let me see. So the gauge symmetries. Gauge symmetries that you can postulate your field to transform under so delta W. So you have a parameter which is a function of space time, of y's, and now also of z's. And the gauge symmetries that you want and B is a sort of, this is S. So these two guys transform as gauge field. And this guy is a sort of adjoint field with a small twist, which is the following. So this is postulated to transform so if I just have a standard adjoint, I would just write epsilon star b minus b star epsilon. Now what Vasiliev found is that to get the correct physical equations of motion, you have to take this b to transform in a different representation, which he calls twisted adjoint. Well, operation. So this pi is just a discrete operation on epsilon. which just flips the sign of the Y's and the Z's. And that can be realized using that Kleinian that this is equivalent to taking the star commutator with the Kleinian. Yes. Right. So probably people don't understand what we are saying, but yes, I'm not using what Vasilev usually uses. The two are related by a shift of z alpha dz alpha plus z alpha dot dz alpha dot. I just prefer to write it in this way. So in my case, in the ADS vacuum, S is going to be zero. While in your case, in the ADS vacuum, S is going to be z alpha dz alpha. Oh, because it's wrong, sorry. It's an epsilon, of course. Yeah. It's just a standard gauge symmetry. Thanks. Okay, now we have all the ingredients to write down the equations. Fine. Okay, the most compact way to write the equations is to introduce, to combine this W and S into a single one form. So we define this as a one form in X and Z space. And then Vasilev, the equations that Vasilev proposes are just this. So we take the curvature of this gauge field, and this is set to be equal. So this kappa and kappa bar are this special objects that have some nice properties under the star product. So this is one equation, and then there is equation for B, which is just this. Okay, so these are Vasilev's equations. Not the most general one. In a second, I will generalize a little bit. So first, we see, since we're here, we are basically using the language of Young-Mills theories. We can see by inspecting these equations that they are gauge invariant under these transformations. It's clear. And this pi twist is the same twist that appears here in the gauge transformation. And so this curvature transform as a usual adjoint, which is why here you have this star k. So the what this kappa does basically is transforming a field which is in this twisted adjoint into a field which is into a standard adjoint. So you can see that if B transform in this funny way, then B star kappa transform as a standard adjoint field without the pi. This is because the pi can be realized as k star epsilon star k, and the k squares to 1. And so they are manifestly gauge invariant, and you can check that they are consistent. For example, the second equation just follows from the Bianchi identity of the first equation. So Bianchi identity tells you that this curvature, let me call this F, So Bianchi identity says that df plus a wedge f minus f wedge a is equal to zero. And it's not too complicated to check that this is exactly consistent if b satisfies the second equation. And for this, it's important that here we only have two z's, so that you don't have a dz, a tree form in z-space. So when you take the d on this object, you cannot take a d with respect to z, for example. That's a crucial part of this proof. And then you can also see that the second one by itself is consistent with the first one if you just apply d on it. So this is a set of consistent equations which have this symmetry, which before we have argued when we restrict epsilon to be a parameter which only depends on y and y bar is related to higher spin symmetry. So Vasilev proposes that this is a natural set of interacting equations which have higher spin symmetry.
Natural would be when you start putting this y, you would just say that it's flat or something like this. So what is the logic? You try to do that, you find that it's inconsistent,
you find that
there's more, and this is the simplest thing you can put it in.
Yes, I mean, it's hard to, well, if you just do that, I think you find something non-interesting, nothing is propagating in the end, if you just write flatness conditions for just those W's that I was writing at the beginning. So I guess you start playing with these things and in the end you figure out that this is the form which gives you the right dynamics. But I mean, there are many steps here for which I personally don't have a full intuition. It's just a proposal and the equations are consistent. They have some gauge symmetry. And then, of course, the non-trivial part is to check whether if you consider linearized fluctuations, they do describe standard propagation of higher spin gauge. That is something you need to check. And the claim is that it is true. If you expand this around the IDS diagram, these equations describe propagation of higher spin gauge proof. And to, at nonlinear order, they are consistent modification which preserve some gauge symmetry. So what else can it be? Is a consistent theory of interacting higher spins. That's a passive proposal.
We expect that f by lambda goes to zero string in ADS form.
Something like this, probably, plus some more, because in that case you don't just get pure higher spin gauge theory. I mean, there is some similarity here with some kind, well, like Witten's string field theory, which you also have a star product and you have some kind of flatness condition, but here there is, I mean, there are some twists that are hard to identify in string field theory, like the need for this twist in the joint and the meaning of this internal space and so on. So maybe there is a connection to string theory, but nobody knows yet how to get these equations from string theory, or something which looks like this equation from string theory. Okay, so these are the form of the equations that you usually see in reviews, but so actually there is a more general form of these equations in which you can just replace this B star kappa with some arbitrary functions of B star kappa. The equation still remains consistent and it describes a more general theory. Well, so f is not the most general function possible. So it was shown by Vasiliev that by doing field redefinitions, you can restrict this function to, let me call this function f of x. This can be restricted to just be lattice form. Where star means that this is a star exponential in which you expand, and powers are star powers. And theta x, it's some even function of x. So the most general Vasiliev's equations are these equations with f chosen in this way, so they are specified by some choice of a phase theta of x. And the example, the simple example I was writing at the beginning just corresponds to theta equal to zero. And so it was actually shown already by Vasiliev and also emphasized later by Sedzkin and Sandel. That if in your theory you require that there is some parity symmetry, if you require a symmetry, so a parity symmetry would exchange y and y bars and z bars. So basically it will exchange these two terms in this equation. So if you require parity symmetry, you have a freedom to choose your scalar master field to be either parity even or parity odd. And if you want that these equations are invariant under parity, you see that this function, sorry, here I should put a star, a bar. So for parity, you find that this function is restricted to this if B transform under parity into itself. So if B is parity even, or it could be that B is parity odd, and then you need to require that f of x is f of star of minus x if b goes to minus b under parity. Now if you look at the form of f, you find that in this case it's...
Yes, I should use the same, just complex configuration.
So under parity, this term, for example, so the dz become dz bar, k become k bar, and b become plus minus b under parity. If you choose it to be plus b, then you have this condition. If you choose it to be minus b, you have this condition. And from the form of f, you see that now if you impose this parity, you only have two options, which are either theta equal to zero, in this case, one implies that theta of x is equal to zero. So f of x is just x. And this is just the theory I wrote at the beginning. It's just a theory in which you have b star k and b star k bar. In the other option, you have that theta of x is pi over 2. So f of x is I of x. So for parity invariant theories, you only have two inequivalent theories. One is this, and the other one, you would just put an I and a minus I here. This was called in the literature a type A Vasilev theory. And this was called a type B. So the difference between these two theories is in the choice of this right-hand side and in the parity of the scalar. So as we will see next time, the conjecture is that this theory is related to scalar vector models. And this theory is related to fermionic vector models. In this case, in the spectrum of primary operators, there is a scalar operator which is parity even, and in this case, there is a scalar operator which is parity odd, and corresponds to the parity odd scalar in the bulk theory.
The general phase.
Yeah.
Did the B equation, was that still unchanged?
This equation.
Yes. Okay. And was there, maybe this isn't a fair question, but was there a motivation or an intuition why parity was an interesting constraint?
It's a symmetry that you can impose. It restricts in the range of theory that you want to consider.
Have these other theories been studied? Did you get?
No, so okay.
Interesting.
Right, so it's what we are studying right now. So most general theories in which you don't impose parity. Then the proposal is that instead of these simple vector models that I wrote down yesterday, you have vector models coupled to Chern-Simon sketches, which do break parity, so they fit into the story. So there is a generalization, a proposed generalization of these conjectures when you do not impose parity, and you have some arbitrary phase there. Then the proposal is that they correspond to some vector models with Chern-Simon's coupling. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is that Chern-Simon for, like, for which gauge algebra is that? For W infinity algebra?
Just SUN.
Oh.
That theory will have primary operators with spins of all integer spins. You could also choose all n, in which case you only have the even spins.
Okay.
I mean, it's just a standard CFT with some vector field in some fundamental representation coupled to a Chern-Simon sketch field with standard SUN. Yes, I was mentioning earlier there is a consistent truncation of highest in algebra to only the even spins, and you can impose this truncation at the level of these equations of motion too. You can restrict the dependence of the master fields on the twister variables in such a way that they only contain even spins. So that's the minimal positive theory. It contains only even spins. And that's supposed to be due to theories with vector models with real fields, or ON vector models. But in general, you can study the non-minimal case, and then you have some vector models with complex fields, which then you have all the integer spins. I didn't finish what I planned to do today, but almost. Should we stop?
Yeah, very good.
Okay,
have tomorrow.
Okay.
This could be the simple quantum filter. No?
You have enough skin.
Yeah.
I cannot put more than enough.
It's enough to do all of
it. That's right.